century records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we give the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Hello, I'm Hank Roth, Morro Bay Friends of the Library. Welcome to our community event, one of many to be hosted by the Morro Bay Friends of the Library. Today's program is co-hosted by the Morro Bay Friends of the Library and the Historical Society of Morro Bay. Before I go on any further, I'd like to draw your attention to the back of the room where we have a number of books, movies, and historical videos of the World War II era. They'll be available at our Morro Bay Library for checkout. I'd like to introduce you to our MC who will be hosting today's event, Gary Ream. Gary Ream is the president of the Historical Society of Morro Bay. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gary.
Thanks very much, Hank. I'm very privileged to be a part of this and honoring our World War II veterans. It's a long time ago, but we need to hear their stories, and we need to know some of the things that they have gone through. I'm going to introduce each of our panel members to you, and then we'll come back, and individually each one will tell us a little bit about who they were and where they were and what they did. So our panel, starting here on my right, is Bob Dixon, John Baker, and Carl Ott. And we're going to start with Bob Dixon, and he's going to tell us his rank and what branch of service he's in and some of those things. Bob?
Yes, during World War II, I was a second lieutenant in the Army Air Forces. I was a B-17 pilot stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. My combat experience was very limited, however. It was the policy over there to have the pilot fly 4 or 5 missions with an experienced crew before he would take his own crew into harm's way. I was on my third such indoctrination mission when we were shot down over the city of Dusseldorf, Germany. The circumstances there were that our target was a chemical plant in Leverkusen, Germany, right in the heart of the Ruhr Valley, and our fighter escort could only take us into the low countries there. Then they had to turn around because of fuel. And as soon as they left, the German fighters jumped us. We took a hit in the number 3 engine with a 20 millimeter from a FW-190. And also our electrical system was partially shot away. With one engine out, we became a straggler, and we had just turned onto the initial point onto the target, and our bomb bay doors were open, which creates quite a bit of drag, and we were unable to keep up with the formation, and the German fighters then ganged up on us. They shot out another engine. This is a four-engine bomber, so we still had two left. But shortly thereafter, I started a fire in the fuel tank behind the number two engine, and that's when we decided to bail out. We weren't exactly sure where we were at the moment, but we turned out we were right over the city of Dusseldorf, Germany. And I was very fortunate. I landed in a plowed field across the Rhine River from Dusseldorf in a residential area there, somebody's victory garden. There was a elderly German man there with a World War I rifle aimed at me just as I landed, so there was no chance to evade capture. Shortly thereafter, a motorcycle with a sidecar comes tearing across the field. There were two Luftwaffe sergeants in there, and they took me into custody, gave me a meal of cabbage soup, and drove me right through the downtown Dusseldorf in their noon rush hour to an airfield on the other side of the city, and there we were put in. I was put into solitary confinement. It wasn't until the next day that I knew that the remainder of our crew, or those that were left, were still in cells adjacent to me. The tail gunner, unfortunately, was killed in the airplane, so of a crew of 10, 9 of us got out. After a stint in their interrogation center, I was sent to Stalag Luft 1. It's a camp for airmen officers, both RAF and American. It's right up on a peninsula jutted out into the Baltic, and I spent 18 months there. The treatment we got, at the time we thought it was terrible. We didn't get enough to eat, and we were crowded, 8 of us into a room designed, or 16 in a room designed for 8. But after the war, I talked to some fellows that were prisoners of the Japanese, and I realized by comparison, we had it pretty good. The camp was liberated by the Russian army on May the 1st of 1945, and we were flown out of a nearby airfield and took a ship home, and I opted to stay in the military, and I was in the Air Force for 11 years, and I got out in 1953 and retired as a captain. That's the end of my story.
Very, very interesting, Bob. We enjoy hearing that, and glad to hear that you were treated fairly well anyway. How many meals a day would you normally get?
We had 2 meals a day. The Germans provided us with staples such as potatoes, some cooked barley, a terrible brown bread, and a few other items, but the goodies came in the form of Red Cross food parcels that had either a can of Spam or a can of corned beef, had powdered milk, that had margarine, cigarettes, a chocolate bar. So we divided ourselves up into combines. 3 or 4 guys would get together and pool their food resources, and we had some pretty inventive guys there. One guy wrote a book on 100 ways to prepare Spam. So we survived.
Good. What was a normal day like? What time did you get up, and what'd you do? And
well, a normal day started with the roll call. The German guards would roust us out, and it was shortly after dawn. And dawn varied, of course. We were pretty far north, and in the winter time, dawn might not come until 8:30 or so. In the summertime, it came around 5 a.m. We lined up outside and were counted, and then turned loose for the remainder of the day. In the evening, there was another roll call and a physical count, and we were then released and went back to our barracks, and the barracks were shuttered at night, so we had no windows or ventilation out in the evening.
So during the day, they didn't have work details for you, or they did?
No, officers by the precepts of the Geneva Convention weren't required to work, so we didn't have anything except our own personal cooking and our own hygiene, washing our clothes, things of that nature.
Pretty glad to get home then when it was over.
Oh, yes. Yep.
That's great. Thanks very much, Bob. Now we're going to hear from John Baker. John, would you give us some information on yourself?
Well, by a rare coincidence, we have 3/8 Air Force people sitting in a row here. My rank was technical sergeant. I was aerial engineer gunner on a B-17. And that entailed helping the pilot on takeoff and landing, observing the engine instruments and all that sort of thing, and helping him make decisions on when to shut an engine down on occasion. Fortunately, then when we got to the combat area, I manned the top turret. I can't top Bob's story. I was very fortunate to survive 32 missions. We flew over Germany and France 32 times and never, in fact, came back with all four engines running every time, which reminds me of another little tale I'll tell in a moment. I started flying in May, and we were stationed in the Midlands of England, and flew through early September and completed the 32 missions, and then was shipped back to the United States. I'll give a couple of highlights that I remember. Coming, it was probably more exciting or more wearing on us getting to England. We flew from Bangor, Maine to Goose Bay, Labrador, and from there to Iceland on the way over with a brand new B-17 entrusted to our care. We had the weather predictions, I guess, in those days weren't as good as they are now. We had an overcast and an undercast and didn't know which way was up, hardly. We had a very good navigator, though, who managed to get a shot of the sun through a hole in the overhead clouds and determined our relationship to Iceland, and we got there. I hoped that I may have played a little part in helped us get there, because I was using my engineering experience, transferring gas from one tank to another to keep all four engines running. Believe it or not, the plane will run more economically on four engines than on any lesser number, because on a lesser number they have to labor so hard. They use more gas. So anyway, we got to Iceland all right, and then got to England, obviously, and flew the 32 missions and came home. One more interesting flight. I think I mentioned that we came home from all the combat missions with all four engines running. When I got back to the States, I was sent to Boca Raton, Florida, to fly as engineer again on radar training missions on B-17s in the Caribbean area. As one of those hurricanes like is hitting the East Coast tomorrow, I guess, came up and was aimed for Florida, where we were stationed. And we got orders to take all the B-17s out to Tinker Field, Oklahoma. So we got our crew together and started out for Tinker Field, Oklahoma. The pilot, he was a rascal, I guess. Are pilots rascals?
No.
Anyway, he had a girlfriend in Dallas. And we happened to bring the crew chief, the ground crew chief, along, as well as the engineer on this flight. It was required, incidentally, on all B-17 flights that an engineer be present. But the pilot said to me and the crew chief, he says, can you do anything to the engines, or make it look like we're having trouble so I can go fly into Dallas, which was a little closer, because I got a girlfriend there I'd like to visit. So the crew chief and I put our heads together, and we decided that if we broke a little wire off of the oil pressure gauge in back of the panel, we could get to it by standing down where the navigator's seat normally was. You could reach up behind the dashboard, so to speak. And we decided we would break a wire off, and we just about made that decision, hadn't touched a wire or anything, and kapow! Number three engine blew a cylinder. The pilot said, what in the hell did you guys do? We didn't do a thing. It happened all by itself. Well, he had his excuse automatically to go to Dallas. So he asked the navigator to set a course for Dallas. About halfway there, kapow again. We blew a cylinder on number two engine. So we had the rest of the flight into Dallas on two engines. Fortunately, that didn't happen in combat, or we might have been like Bob was, jumped by the fighters when we lagged behind. There fortunately were no fighters over Texas that day. At least if they were, they were friendly ones. So the other interesting part of that was I got delayed in Dallas for so long that they were looking for me to discharge me when I got, before I got back to Boca Raton. But I managed to get discharged in October of 1945 anyway. Thank you.
Great, John. We appreciate that. What were some of the conditions like in the plane when you were flying in some of these missions? I'm sure it isn't well heated or ventilated, or it's probably not real comfortable.
Well ventilated.
It's probably not real comfortable. What were some of the conditions?
It was mostly cold.
Mostly cold.
But they had invented a flying suit, which essentially was a heated blanket made into the form of long johns. And you wore that under your regular flying clothes. And if you were lucky, didn't get any short circuits, you kept warm. I managed to keep warm most of the time. One of my gloves burned out one day, but that was a minor inconvenience. I put on one of the big heavy mittens that we carried and managed to survive all right.
Did you fly in the same plane for the entire duration there, or were there several planes?
Most of the time in the same plane.
What was the name of that plane?
You would ask. I think we, from all you read in the papers and magazines and books and stuff, Noah's Ark, as they've called it, was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Every plane had a picture on it, and every plane had a name on it. For some reason or other, we weren't artistic enough, I guess, or something. We never named our plane or anything, or had any pictures put on it.
Well, thanks for your time this morning. Now, Carl,
thank you.
What have you got for us?
Well, as was mentioned, I was also in the 8th Air Force. Seemed to be a popular place. I got in the service in the cadet program, and they allowed us to stay home for some, must have been about 5 or 6 months. I guess they didn't have room. And then we finally reported and went to pre-flight training and went into pilot training. Unfortunately, after washing back one class, I still didn't make it. So then I switched over to Bombardier Navigator in San Angelo, Texas. I finished that in 43, and after the first leave I think I'd had in about a year, went to Salt Lake City, and our crew was put together, and then we were shipped to Colorado to get crew training. After that, I guess I think I mentioned that I was a bombardier navigator. It was they were teaching bombardiers how to be DR and pilot navigators, so that if something happened to the regular navigator, they could fill in. We were finally sent to England and the 8th Air Force, which pleased me because I like the accommodations and stuff over there. I mean, when you were at the base, it was nice, and that helped make up for when you weren't at the base. But the other thing that was nice and was that by the time we got there, which was in about April of 44, the German Air Force was no longer the Air Force that once existed. Not that they still didn't have a sting, but not to the same degree. And so we got a break on that. Most of our losses were from anti-aircraft. At that particular time, the Germans were using anti-aircraft across on the B-24s, I guess I failed to mention that's what I ended up in, and using their fighters against the B-17s, which, while I didn't like flak, was all right with me. I'll take the flak any day over the fighters. But I was in the 392nd Bomb Group and Wendling, and I flew 30 missions, well, actually about 32, but we didn't get credit for two of them. One, the target was closed in, and so they didn't give us credit. The other was on D-Day, and we blew a cylinder head and had to come back and with a full bomb and gas load and land on three engines, which meant you were probably going to get one chance, but it worked out. There was one interesting thing that happened there that we were on a mission. I do not recall whether it was the 10th or 15th or what. And by the time we got there, there was fighter escort. And fighter escort made all the difference in the world. A group of fighters, P-51s, would pick you up at the coast maybe and take you in maybe to the border of Germany, and then they'd go down and strafe ground targets and places and things such as that. And another group would pick you up, or squadron, and they'd stay with you, you hoped, all the way to the target and back. That made a great difference. Like I say, the German fighters didn't pick on us much. They picked on the B-17s. But there was one day there when we were on a mission, and we were in formation there. And we looked over there, and here was a FW-190 German fighter plane that had pulled up into our formation between our plane and the one across from us. There was just enough room for him there. And it was one of those things, you know, you looked at it and you keep thinking, I'm imagining this. What's a German fighter doing up between us? Well, he was running away from the fighters that was protecting us. They were looking for him, and he was up in the formation. But our next worry was that one of the gunners was going to get trigger happy, and he might not only get the F-190, but also the B-24 behind it. So I don't know how long he stayed there, but I was glad when he left, because as it was in both planes, ours and the one across from us, nobody could decide whether to shoot or not. And I suppose we possibly said, just leave it be. We don't want to shoot each other down. Anyway, that was quite an experience. It sounds like something out of a Hollywood picture, but it was true. By the time I'd finished 30 missions, I'd been promoted to a first lieutenant, and returned home and went to instructor school, and then instructed the new classes of navigators coming up in B-29s and stuff in manual bombing. Well, by manual, I mean with the Norden bomb sight. By then, they were getting fancier radar ways to bomb and things like that. And I stayed in the service, and then finally decided to get out and joined the reserve. And I was in the reserve for quite some time. We finally got into a B-26 outfit. And I was doing flying every weekend, and part of the reasons enjoying it was to pick up a little extra money. But if you didn't have the required number of people in the squadron, the flight crews didn't get paid. So as it turned out, I finally decided that it was costing me to be in the reserve. So I was getting ready to resign, and the next thing I knew, I had a telegram saying to report to active duty, but that's another story. That was the Korean War. But I've skipped over. I didn't realize we were going to, you know, get into much detail, and I didn't remember all of it, I'm sure. But it was a very interesting thing, but I was glad when it was over.
Carl, how many crew members were there on a B-24?
There was 10, but we did not use one. They took the belly turrets out of the B-24 because it slowed them down and they could carry more bombs if they took the turret off, which left us with a surplus crew member that sort of had to catch his rides here and there. Like I say, the heavy attacks by German aircraft on us had passed, and so the belly turret wasn't missed like it had been previously. The B-17s, I think, still kept them, but we didn't.
What kind of airspeed could you get?
I'm trying to remember. It seemed to me we were about indicated 165 to 175. I shouldn't know exactly, but I don't recall because our navigator was killed in a crash, and so I finished as navigator, and I had to do the regular type of navigation rather than to help. So I should know the speed, but it's been a long time ago. And supposedly we could carry more bombs than the 17, I don't know personally. And I think we were a little faster, but we couldn't go as high.
Great.
And I think that's why the Germans switched their deal from flak to planes against the B-17s. But that's about it. There's a lot there I've missed, but I didn't come prepared for too long a deal.
We appreciate the time you've given us. Bob, what kind of speed did the B-17s have?
The indicated airspeed was about 165, but at altitude, because you're in thinner air, while your actual ground speed is over 200 miles an hour.
And what kind of an altitude would you fly at while you're approaching, coming to a target?
25,000 to 27,000 feet were the common bombing altitudes.
Great. Well, that concludes our interview with our veterans. Now we're going to hear from Jim Wood. He's going to tell us a little bit about some of the things that happened here in Morro Bay a little bit. Many of you may or may not know that we had a battalion of soldiers at the old Cloisters Inn for some time. They were brought here right at the beginning of the war to protect the oil field or the oil tanks that we had. And they were here about a year and then they moved on. But we also had a large naval base here. And the naval base was here to train the soldiers that were going to be disembarking from landing crafts. And this was all done down in the Embarcadero. There is a map of the naval base that's going to be posted in the Veterans Hall very soon. The Historical Society was able to come up with that, and it is one of the original maps of the layout, and so you want to stop by there someday and take a look at that. And Jim's going to tell us now a little bit about the Higgins Landing Crafts and the Higgins Company. Jim?
Welcome. This is a last minute thing here, so. Higgins boats were manufactured in World War II. Andrew Jackson Higgins owned a small fleet of schooners and brigantines that he used to run up and down the Mississippi and out of Louisiana, carrying goods. And in the 30s, he incorporated Higgins Industries in New Orleans. 1937, the U.S. Coast Guard decided they needed some sort of personnel transport carrier, and he came up with a boat called the Eureka, which in Morro Bay, if you'll remember back to the abalone days, a lot of the guys, you still see a few of them around, what are affectionately referred to as duck bills. They were little 36-foot boats with kind of a funny little flat nose on them. And that was the basis for our abalone fleet. These boats were built for one-way trips, actually. They put these boats together as landing craft. They were designed to make one trip to the beach. In the late 30s, just before World War II, Higgins was approached to build some landing craft for the Marine Corps, which was known as the LCVP. And over the course of time, 20,000 of these vessels were built. Higgins built 20,000 vessels in a little factory in New Orleans, which is now the present-day home of the D-Day Museum, founded by Stephen Ambrose. I had an opportunity to visit that a couple years ago, and if you get a chance to go to New Orleans, you should go there. They've reconstructed one of these Higgins boats. There weren't any left, and they reconstructed one at Custom. They wanted to make it as authentic as possible. They had to manufacture a lot of the parts, and it cost them $1,080,000 to build this boat for display in the museum and keep it authentic. They had to manufacture parts. They brought in a bunch of the old-timers that worked in the factory to put this thing together, and it's a great display. If anybody's interested, you can go to HigginsBoatProject.org on the internet, and actually it's HigginsBoat.org, and you can get a lot of information on how this project took place and how it happened. As far as Andrew Higgins himself, Higgins was General Dwight D. Eisenhower later said if there was one man who could have said to have won the war, it would be Andrew Jackson Higgins, and it's because of his tenacity, so to speak, of being able to put together a factory and build these boats, much like the B-17s. They were just pushing them out the door, and you know, we had a war effort going on, and they were building more planes than cars. They were building more boats than cars. You know, it's just something that probably couldn't be done today. Basically, that's it. When they were building these boats, they were about $12,000 to build one. At the beginning, it was costing Higgins himself $241 per boat to put the boat out the door for the war effort. We had a amphibious assault training center here in Morro Bay, and the boats they were using were Higgins boats, which were really adaptations of that first duck-bill boat. They had a ramp on them, gray marine diesel, and the ramp, they carried 36 people. So they would carry these across the sea on landing ships, LSTs, landing ship transports, and load 36 soldiers into it, and away they'd go, and they'd hit the beach. And if you've ever seen Private Ryan or know about D-Day, then you know what happened from then on. It wasn't an easy job, and that's about all I've got to say about the Higgins boat. Like I said, you can get more information at HigginsBoat.org, and I'd like to thank these people and all of the people at that time that put us where we are today. It was an effort. We shouldn't forget it. I was a small boy at the time. My father was off. He was in the Navy, a CB, building a runway on Guam for the end of the Pacific Theater portion of the war, and didn't meet him until I was 5. So everybody made great sacrifices at that time, and I want to thank all of you for that.
Thanks, Jim. Yes, we certainly do owe the veterans of World War II and the Korean conflict and Vietnam and the others that we've had, we owe them a great deal of appreciation. As those in World War II grow a little bit older, we're not going to have them around for a long time to interview them. That's why I think today's program is really important, to hear your stories, the sacrifices that you made, some of the hard times that you went through. And we hope that those that come to the other programs will understand what's going on and what has made the United States such a great country to live in and to be a part of. And so again, we appreciate Bob and John and Carl, Jim, we appreciate Hank and his introductions. And that'll conclude our program for this afternoon. And thank you for viewing this.
Company B. And when he plays boogie woogie bugle, he was busy as a bee. And when he plays, he makes the company jump A to the bar. He's a boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Do 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 da da do da da do do. He blows it A to the bar. He can't blow a note if the bass and guitar isn't with him. And the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's a boogie woogie bugle.
Them up the same way in the early bright. They clap their hands and stamp their feet because they know how he plays. When someone gives him a beat, he really breaks it up. When he plays reveille, he's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. Boogie, boogie, bugle boy, I'm coming.